Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Hello? Okay, I can't hear you, you might be able to hear me. Probably a good chance you can. Now I hear you.
Alright.
Yeah.
Very good. Should we be seeing each other, or is hearing sufficient?
Hearing is sufficient for me. We can have video if you want.
Nah.
Okay.
I didn't dress for the occasion.
So I was just looking into Keyhole Factory a bit more. I mean, obviously I've looked into it because that was why Gary recommended you, but I haven't read it. I haven't had time. I actually just found out that it's in the library system, so I've just ordered it.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm looking forward to it because having read the reviews, it sounds very much like the kind of thing that I really get into, and that's probably why Gary suggested that I talk to you. It seems that it covers two of my primary, I was going to say primordial, maybe both, interests, being language as a virus and the end of the world.
Indeed it does. Or more specifically, in this case, ideas as a virus, or the idea of capitalism as a virus. The virus is used literally as well as figuratively in a number of ways.
What's used literally?
The idea of virus.
Mm-hmm. So give me a bit more background on the book then, if you can, if it's not too tiresome to describe a work that you've done.
Not at all. When I began the work around the year 2000, there was not quite the proliferation of end of the world media that we now have. There were no end of the world TV shows, and there are even now documentaries on both the History Network and National Geographic channel about what would happen to the world if human beings disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether, since it took me 5 years to write and 7 more to get it published, whether to be disappointed that the premise is now overdone, or whether I actually owe the fact of its getting published to the end of the world becoming popular.
Because you got published in 2012, no less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The book itself is tries to find the comfortable line, because, you know, I was academically trained as a novelist, where in programs where storytelling and the old tropes of character and plot were frowned upon as trite and talked about as if they were actually easy to pull off, but they happen to be an interest of mine. So there's a lot of formal experimentation overlying a actual story with characters that itself is kind of hard to follow and is purposefully not fully resolved. The idea being that if the world actually did end in the sense that most of the human race, or at least its authority, died off, there would be no master narrative to tell that story. And some people think it's the revolution has finally come. Others think Planet Earth has cleansed itself. Others sees it as an opportunity for violence. Some have a religious interpretation. So with the breakdown of society comes the breakdown of a story about it. And in that respect, the novel has an ending, but not the kind of whodunit closure that some readers might itch for.
Because there's a mystery that is unraveling through the course of the novel, you mean?
Well, if someone were to, you know, if there was a catastrophe that killed off most of the people, naturally you'd want to blame someone.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in that sense of whodunit, I see. So that notion of the world as a story is a very strong one in itself. I mean, of course, the end of the world itself is the end of a narrative. I mean, it's a narrative end device. So, and the, you know, the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the way that that ends with a bang, literally, and begins. The Old Testament begins, of course, with the beginning of the world, and so that whole notion of our existence as being a story does depend on it having an ending.
Yes, I don't know to whom to attribute the quote that history is written by the victors, but in a scenario where there are no winners, then no history gets written, and that is what I was after. So instead we have personal anecdotes in a fragmented mosaic.
And how does this tie in with then the I guess the more discrete theme of language as a virus? I mean, is that overt in the book, or is it implied by the form that you've given the narrative?
There's at least one chapter. They're either chapters or short stories, so I was kind of formally playing with the idea of a collection of stories that cohere somehow. But there's one that is devoted exclusively to that idea. So in that story, which is very abstract, it's not clear who the narrator is, there's a metaphor within a metaphor. So the earth is the being, the humans are the virus that infest it, and they kill themselves off through their own thought virus, which is the capitalist system, which sort of metastasizes and becomes the only idea for distributing goods and necessities. And as a result, weaponry is created and wars happen and biological weaponry is created and biological weaponry gets out of control. Mm-hmm. But biological weaponry having its roots in nature, it's not clear whether the earth is behind it all.
Right. Right, so that's the extinction event is... The idea of the dieback relates to that, you know, the nature. Well, in fact, there's even one theory, and if you've heard it, I don't know how reputable it is. I think I heard it through Whitley Strieber, the alien abductee testified, but that nature or the Earth created humanity as a way to bring about an extinction event. So the planet could, you know, get a reset.
To bring about an extinction event of which species?
Of all, well, maybe not all of them, but the majority. It's just to accelerate things.
To reboot?
Yeah, to reboot the whole ecosystem. Like I said, I don't know if that's a science fiction scenario or an actual hypothesis or both.
It sounds plausible if we can ascribe agency to the ecosystem, and I don't see why not. Uh-huh. Human beings are very selfish with ascribing agency pretty much just to ourselves and our cats.
So how do you feel about, because another thing that's become much more predominant since you started the novel is the idea, this idea of humanity as a virus, and the idea that the Earth would be better off without humans, and ideas like that, you know, more sort of environmentalist ideas. How do you feel about those kind of memes?
I am a fan of those memes. So in that sense, my end of the world story could be described as having a happy ending, because everybody dies and eventually all the, you know, over the next ensuing centuries, the cars will decompose, the nuclear power plants will melt down and poison things, but eventually that will blow over as well. At the end of the novel, the oceans are rising and beginning to cover North America as if to wash it off.
News poem, June 2013, Millennium in Review. The meaning of
weather
has changed forever. Formerly innocuous, neutral, pleasant at worst, the safest of topics. Now dark, ominous, spooky, politically divisive. The
economy
will not
recover.
The meaning of
retirement
has changed forever. Formerly gilded, Floridian, populist, gaudy, Hawaiian shirt patterned. Now as cruel and senseless as
private island.
The meanings of
media, information, entertainment, communication, knowledge
have changed forever. Formerly abstract, formal, dull. Now, quietly exploding in your pocket, millions of pennies.
I read a quote from Patricia Highsmith a little while ago. It was in one of her novels, speculating about this. Well, she was questioning, or the character was questioning, why human beings love to think of society and culture and civilization continuing indefinitely. And why it isn't at least as comforting to think of everything being completely eradicated and there being nothing but empty space, which I thought was rather characteristic of Highsmith. I don't know if you've read her, but...
have not.
Well, she's not known for her human warmth, yeah.
It's a good question.
Yeah. So is there a spiritual dimension? Because we're going quite deep, well, at least wide or broad with this. I mean, the whole idea of extinction is one that I think is a very valid idea. I mean, of course, sooner or later it's going to happen unless you have a transhumanist view that somehow we can extend ourselves into infinity and become techno-gods or stuff like that, which I don't really ascribe to. Then the idea of, I mean, the recognition, acceptance that everything that we know and are is going to be completely obliterated and leave no traces, I think is a very necessary one to keep in mind at all times, but it's not a very popular one, of course. So would you say there's a spiritual dimension to this outlook that you're propagating in your own mimetic delivery fiction, if such it is?
I think there is a spiritual dimension. And I guess in the snapshot, if you can call 12 years a snapshot of my own thinking on the subject, the higher power in question would be the ecosystem, of which in the book and arguably in real life, humans have removed themselves. So, Mother Earth is God or the goddess, and all-knowing and all-powerful, at least within her sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So almost every kind of catastrophe happens, natural catastrophe happens in the book, except for volcanoes. I couldn't work in a volcano. I was disappointed. But there can be a sequel.
Did you like disaster movies when you were growing up?
I think I did. I've always... I feel like I grew up in a particular golden age of dystopias, starting with what I think was George Lucas's first or second film before he was big news, THX 1138. That was part of a whole series of underground utopias, more or less cheesy, including Logan's Run and Soylent Green. I think that was above ground, but the same kind of vibe. From there into the late 70s, we moved into the my favorite genre of dystopian science fiction, which I'd call the industrial proletariat science fiction. So, for example, the movie Alien, while on its surface it's an effective horror movie, it's kind of about these miners who are being exploited by their company to bring back this alien that can be used for biological weapons research. Around the same time, there was Outland with Sean Connery, which is about, again, about miners on a moon of Jupiter whose company is feeding them drugs that make them super productive, and then they die before they can get paid. And most recently, Moon, where we have, a sort of miner on the moon who discovers some unpleasant truths about his employment situation. Fantastic film. I've forgotten the question, but it's been fun to riff.
Yeah, what was it? Oh, disaster movie.
Ah, yes. I guess when I was growing up, there was a string of them, but they'd be things like The Towering Inferno and Airplane.
Airplane was the spoof. Yeah.
Oh, you're right, Airport. I apologize. It wasn't in, what am I thinking of? The Deep? There's what?
The Deep was the sort of follow-up to Jaws, except it didn't have a shark in it.
It wasn't really until after September 11th that we began being fed these complete global apocalypse special effects blockbusters to, you know, help us remain completely paranoid.
I think there were a few. I mean, Deep Impact and Armageddon were pre 9/11, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Independence Day, if that counts.
Yeah. I think there's always been a fascination with grand-scale catastrophes. I mean, how could there not be, really? It's the thing about slowing down for car crashes as well. There's a fascination, perhaps relating to this not really being able or wanting to think about our own mortality, and so then needing and desiring some more vicarious experience of it.
I might add to that it is also in this genre of movies, a fine way to deal with the theme of loneliness, which I think is hard to get at directly, but we have, I could name a lot of movies where we have one person who believes they are the only one alive and are attempting to stay sane.
So that's a very existential scenario, I guess. Again, a kind of magnifying the experience that we all have to some extent of being isolate in our own heads, our own consciousness.
Yes. If there is no society, then what is a person?
Right. If there's no group to define us. So. That's the question we get into a lot on this podcast. I say we, I mean the people I talk to, because it's a prevailing question that that I'm wrestling with all the time. Are you interested in psychology, for example, or in Jungian psychology and individuation?
I am, though admittedly I am a failed psychology major. So I began my college career majoring in psychology and did rather poorly and switched to creative writing. I think in part this was due to just doing poorly. I think in part I expected the science of psychology to have, you know, more advanced answers like physics and astronomy seemed to have than it did at the time. But I also couldn't overlook the fact that I took abnormal psychology in a tremendous lecture hall where I was accountable to no one. It's like hundreds and hundreds of students, and failed it and retook it, got a good grade. And sometime shortly after that, my housemate had a manic episode over the course of a week, literally went insane, and I was unprepared for it. I didn't see it coming. I didn't understand what was happening and was really traumatized by it. So the inefficacy of that class to actually prepare me for the reality of abnormal psychology was underscored. So the answer is yes, I am interested, but you might have to walk me through individuation.
Well, I suppose I could, but I don't want to be doing all the talking. And I'm kind of interested by that transition that you made from psychology to creative writing. By the way, I was just reading a thread about at a forum about how the CIA was involved in creative writing courses. Did you ever hear that?
Well, no. I did hear you talk to Gary Haidt in a couple podcasts back about the Saunders book.
Yeah.
But I think you just talked about abstract expressionist painting, so I'd be delighted to hear that anecdote.
Yeah, well, I don't have an anecdote that's new to me, but it wasn't entirely new because it's part of the Council for Cultural Freedom thing that the CIA was involved in Britain, was actually creating a leftist movement and recruiting all of these writers. And I mean, it's just like a who's who list of the most respected writers of that period, people like Arthur Koestler and oh my god, I can't even, there's just so many of them. But the Congress for Cultural Freedom was an anti-communist advocacy group founded in 1950. Encounter was their literary magazine, founded in 1953 by poet Stephen Spender, originally associated with the anti-Stalinist left, received covert funding from the CIA. Writers who wrote for Encounter included Robert Graves, Stephen Spender, Melvin J. Lasky, John Strachey, Evelyn Waugh, Virginia Woolf, W.H. Auden, Arthur Koestler, Anthony Burgess, Ted Hughes, Jorge Luis Borges, Dwight MacDonald, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Kingsley Amis, Malcolm Bradbury, R.D. Lang, Solzhenitsyn, Marshall McLuhan, Philip Larkin, Paul Theroux, Elias Canetti, D.M. Thomas, David Lodge, Martin Amis, Clive James. Most of them, of course, didn't know that they were essentially working for the CIA. And it came out in the 60s in New York Times and various other periodicals reported on it, and so they were sort of busted, but the magazine continued anyway regardless. And the creative writing thing was part of that, apparently, but that in the US, that the CIA invested in various creative writing programs in order to covertly steer the direction in which fiction writing would continue, I guess.
Well, that's a delicious theory.
Uh-huh.
One of the philosophical themes in Keyhole Factory that I think the one that Gary was most excited by was the idea that there was a government program to discredit the idea of reality. So all the words that seemed to refer to veracity were being subverted. So there was the Real News Network within the novel, which was, you know, a ubiquitous news network like CNN, but all they showed was computer simulations of things. And just everything from real orange juice, which didn't contain oranges, to this is actually a sign I saw driving when I went to Brown. I would always, on the highway, pass a sign that said Historic Providence. And I thought that was odd because it was actually, you know, contemporary Providence. So anyway, the idea was that if they could, you know, just discredit the whole idea of there being a truth,
mm-hmm.
it would be very, you know, much easier to manipulate people's opinions.
Right. Isn't that the world we're living in, to some extent?
Yeah.
I mean, there's relativism to begin with, so...
I can't, yes, there, it's not to say that, you know, the idea that there is an undisputable objective truth is not somewhat suspicious to begin with, but...
Particularly that word objective, I think.
Yes.
Because if there wasn't a subject, well then, you could say anything you like about it, right? You're never going to be able to corroborate it.
Yes.
But, yeah, I mean, I couldn't define relativism, but just this idea that, you know, everything's relative and truth is relative, and that seems to have got everywhere now, and as in that's just your opinion, really, is what is becoming more and more of a kind of rejoinder, and that combined with, of course, political correctness, there are certain things that it's not okay to say or even think, regardless of whether they're true or not. Of course, because truth is just relative anyway, I think that makes a kind of diabolical combination. And one of the areas in which, to me, it's apparent is, I mean, I mentioned transhumanism, and that's a safer target, because I could name less safe ones like transgenderism and whatnot, but where biology is being talked about as if it was relative, really, like men and women are the same. Like, there's certain areas of feminism which find it offensive, or I guess I should say individuals who find it offensive if you say that men and women are biologically different now.
Yes. This vexes me a bit. Not that particular point, but what I sometimes call yuppie sexuality used to be very simple spectrum to define one's sexuality on, and it was also considered reasonable to be personal about it. Now there are many terms like cis and non-binary that people get offended if you use the wrong term or gendered pronoun.
Mm-hmm. I don't know those particular terms. What are they? Cis and non-binary.
Well, what a relief. I'm living in the middle here in this liberal town of a minefield of touchy people with who may actually be just married, monogamous heterosexuals, but who have very complicated descriptions of their sexuality that they seem very offended if you get wrong.
Right. Okay. Continue. This is very interesting.
It's It is, as you said, hard to talk about. There is, you may remember Wheaties box athlete Bruce Jenner, and you may have heard the news stories about how he had a sex change operation to become Caitlyn Jenner.
I did, yeah.
And he's part of this clan of people called the Kardashians that I hope you have not heard about, but this is what passes for celebrities.
Have heard about them just recently by chance, but yeah.
Yeah, I have a friend who keeps me on top of the things that everybody knows that I'd rather not, but in any event, so I know a musician who made a comment about this Caitlyn Jenner that did not portray them as a hero. It was kind of ambivalent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's a rich, frivolous person in a rich, frivolous family who is making a move to get lots of attention for themselves. And this attitude was considered highly oppressive and caused them to lose many Facebook friends.
Right. But not their job.
I don't think this particular musician has a job. He does. He keeps it very well hidden. But he was baffled by the backlash. But I have to say I agree with him that I don't care what kind of junk Bruce Jenner has. He's an empty celebrity to me.
Mm.
Not a symbol of liberation.
Right.
Now I will deftly steer this topic onto... this is my favorite part of the, it's essentially all condensed in a poem in Keyhole Factory that a man reads to his dying wife, the poet named Max Winchester. So I, as a writer among writers and proofreaders, find that many people have their pet peeves, be it the grocer's apostrophe. You know, there are certain usage things that get under people's skin, certain forms of incorrect usage that people are unnecessarily indignant about, that they consider them evidence that society is sliding into the mud because, you know, the word comprise has slowly going from being a synonym to include to being a synonym for compose or misusing whom. So... you know, I like these kinds of conversations, but I don't want to be too much of a prick. So the one usage thing I've decided that will be my cause is the word literally.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. Yeah.
It is it's becoming misused just as an intensifier, as in, I was in a different world, literally.
Yeah. Her head exploded, literally. Yeah, okay.
Yes. The trouble is that once this word disappears, there is no synonym for it to distinguish between literal and figurative language. So is the war on terror literally a war? I think it's not. I think it's a figurative war. I think a war is fought between two nations that are, you know, more or less, you know, equally matched. Maybe a better example is the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not a real war. So this misuse of the word war is really depriving the word of its power and menace and terror and making it very hard to actually take a stand against war because it's become meaningless and because a literal war and a figurative war are the same thing. And as a pacifist or just a guy who thinks killing other people is amoral, this is deeply troubling to me. There's no longer any political platform, except in like certain corners of the far left, that is anti-war. It's taken for granted that the United States is going to be at war forever. And this is not the narrative I was fed during the Cold War when I grew up. That narrative was that after the Soviet Empire fell, since they were standing in the way of a peaceful world, we would then have that peaceful world that America had been trying so hard to obtain. And of course, the next year we invaded Iraq, and that was my political awakening. I'm talking about the first of many, but 1991, the George H.W. Bush version.
Right.
I don't even know if that was a literal war. That was almost like a violent assault on an unarmed person. There was a wonderful article by George Lakoff called Metaphor and War. The metaphor system used to justify war in the Gulf. George Lakoff has a way of writing really tight sentences like reality exists. And yeah.
Tiny specks of dust are falling through the atmosphere. Sunlight passes through them, they don't easily appear. Some fall on the water, some fall on the land, some of them will fall on you if you hold out your hand. Father, oh, and mother, how is there such great alarm? If you cannot see them, then how can they do you harm? They can make you suffer, they can make you change. They are over Norway, and quite soon we'll be in range. All our teeth are falling out like leaves upon the ground. All our hair is falling out, no other can be found. Some are dying slowly, some are dying fast. Some of us hold on to life as long as we can last. Poison and invisible, it falls all round the world. 1,500 rintogens for every boy and girl. We just read the papers, we just watch TV. Passive as the cattle, we await our destiny.
So you have an interesting way of riffing, because I'm not sure when I'm interrupting or not. Are you on your way to a conclusion, or is this an open-ended?
Well, it's open-ended.
Okay. So I'm thinking, while you're speaking, but also now, about this question of war then, you know, what is literally war? And then you probably know the Nietzschean thing, not that I'm a Nietzsche advocate, but obviously he's had a lot of influence. That peace is just the rest period between wars, or something like that. He turned the axiom on its head, or whatever. That we, you know, ideally we think of war as just these periods between periods of peace, but he argued for the opposite, which history would seem to bear out. But of course Nietzsche was glorifying war in a sense. I mean, he had a kind of poetic view of it, at least some of the time. And then you got the Bhagavad Gita. Have you ever read that?
Not yet.
Okay, so that's a Hindi holy book in which Aruna, I don't know how to pronounce it, but talks to Krishna before he's about to go to war. He doesn't want to fight because his family are on the other side and he's going to be killing his family members for whatever reason. I don't know what the political situation was, but anyway, division in the family, obviously. And Krishna's encouraging him and telling him to be a man and not to worry, because this is all just the dance of life, and that it's all karmic, and that the spirits will live on, and that, whatever, various deep rationale that Krishna provides. But the essence of it is that war is a metaphor. War, actual war, literal war, is itself a metaphor for something else, which then brings me to think about nature. And we don't think of what goes on in nature as war, or in the universe when stars explode and planets collide and stuff like that. We don't think of that as war either. So it's almost like we don't really know, or I say I don't really know what war is. I mean, the simplest sense, it seems to me, between two vying powers fighting for dominance, that would be a simple definition of war to me. And I wonder if that's ever been the case. If even World War II was a negotiation, the Bank of England funding the Nazis and the Allies at the same time. In other words, there were powers outside of the battle who were playing both sides. Well, is even that really a war?
It's a good question. It does relate to what I said earlier about human beings being selfish with their agency. We don't like to believe that stars and galaxies do things because they want to, or even that nature does something because it wants to. It's very odd. We seem to think that from a scientific point of view, that the entire universe is a pinball machine of colliding particles that just go on their way because of the laws of physics, but not people. People are different because we think and act and make decisions, but everything else is entirely random.
And at the same time, perfectly ordered. Mm-hmm. Like a machine.
Yes.
Which is possibly a side point, but the idea of the mechanistic universe is actually self-contradictory, because machines are built by someone for a purpose.
That's true.
Whereas the people who believe in a mechanistic universe, they're refuting that very idea also.
Yes.
So it seems as though we're not able to really think clearly about these matters.
I could drop in here yet another keyhole factory has many thoughtful themes that don't necessarily propel the narrative, but are obsessions of the various characters. Mm. So as long as we're talking about the mechanistic universe, as best as I can tell, so there's a character who is a poet astronaut. So he's an astronaut who is on a mission to Alpha Centauri. He doesn't know it, and the reader doesn't know it, but he is delivering a bomb there because they are testing a weapon to destroy a planet. But because of the time distortion, as he leaves Earth and the virus breaks out and society collapses, this news doesn't quite catch up to him until he orbits the star and returns. And then he gets it all very quickly, when there's no time to respond. In order to write this, this is what physicists call the twins paradox, I really had to try to understand the theory of relativity, which does not come easy for me, the Newtonian physics. And, you know, in high school, we had many word problems that were just how to play pool, you know, the momentum of a pool ball on a frictionless surface. But Einstein's model is not very intuitive. In any event, what I take from it is that there is no true simultaneity. Therefore, there is no true present. Therefore, there is no true past or future. Let me know if you need me to expand on any of this. And so this particular character is able to remember the future. So she's has basically the same mechanism for being able to recall the future that most people do the past. And it is her contention that everyone has this ability to see into the future. We've just blocked it out because it's a traumatic memory of our own death.
Right.
So that is seems to be another conceit of, I'm using conceit here to mean conceited, but while we believe that history is immutable, when clearly it's, you know, can be rewritten, but that the future is entirely plastic, and the things we do and say on this podcast are going to have a butterfly effect that is going to create monsoons in India, that the future is entirely under our control and our agency, but the past is not. But there's nothing in the, as best I understand it, current physical model of the universe to explain how the past and future could be any different. Technically, your past and future is slightly different from mine because where are you anyway?
British Columbia.
British Columbia.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Are you, what city?
You can't go small talk when you've just laid all that on me.
Well.
No, I have to have a chance at a rejoinder. Yes, because there were several points that, not that I would require extrapolation, but just a deepening or something in there. Because if you're talking about, I mean, I didn't quite understand the no simultaneity. What was the word you used?
Simultaneity?
That word, yeah, it's not a word I've ever had to use. Hopefully I never will again. But that point, but I understood what you extrapolated from it, which is that there's no present moment, which I think is true. I mean, I think that we, because everything we experience is in the past, this is why I don't accept these spiritual people who tell me not to live in the past. We're always living in the past. Like, if we have any experience of ourselves existing, it's a memory. Even if it's a micro millisecond from what just happened, still our experience is of a memory of that just happened. So it does seem that there is no present, so then, yeah, there would be no past or future either, so essentially you're saying there's no time, right?
Yes. I could give another example that although it appears we are having like a synchronous conversation as though we are in the same room, there is a tiny imperceptible lag that, you know, during which this electrical impulse has to travel through the internet to get back and forth. So when I say now,
yeah,
you hear it, you know, a billionth of a second later. I'm not sure that illustrates my point as well as I had hoped, but it adds to the mind-bogglingness of the thread.
The meaning of friend. The meaning of
war
has changed forever. Formerly dark, ominous, spooky, politically divisive. Now, innocuous, tedious, inscrutable. A category of news as unavoidable and unlistenable as
crop report.
Why? My baby daughter will someday ask, abruptly shifting the burden of explaining this mess onto my generation. 78 million relieved boomers may sigh quietly into their Hawaiian shirt-patterned caskets. She will never know it's possible for her country not to be at war. That
war
formerly meant the exception, not the rule. And to my someday baby granddaughter, the meaning of
trees
has changed forever. Formerly plants, now branching data structures.
Plants.
Formerly life, now cited for discharges of hexavalent chromium into sewers, lack of a permit to store hazardous waste, and failure to train workers. The meaning of
meaning
has changed forever. But
air
is still
free.
So here's a continuation, anyway, of what you were unpacking there. There's no time, whatever that means, because we're in time as we regard this concept in a temporal space. But anyway, so then why is it that we experience time? And I won't make this a question more than a statement, but what have you thought about how this has to do with language? And that, because, I mean, there's this, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, Brian Rotman, but he's written some very interesting stuff about how the I, the self-reflective identity, the ego, whatever you want to call it, what I assume all of us experience unless we're enlightened or, you know, retards, I'm not supposed to use that word, that I is a result of internalized language, because when you have an internal dialogue that creates sentences, you need a subject. Every sentence needs a subject, and the subject is I. And so essentially we have a narrated self, and that narrated self narrates its existence. It keeps narrating itself into existence, and it turns its existence into a story. And that might relate, I think, tentatively, to why we experience time when there isn't time. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Did it spark any response?
Well, I should say that I'm very flattered that it sounds like you just asked me what is time and how does it relate to language, and I don't know if I'm able to rattle that off, but I am of the opinion that I don't know if you're familiar with, I mentioned him before, George Lakoff and the contemporary theory of metaphor.
No.
Some great stuff. At the fundamental premise there is that metaphor, thinking of one thing in terms of another, generally an abstract thing like love in terms of a very physically familiar thing like disease, is a fundamental cognitive mechanism that is hardwired into the brain. And I believe that about narrative and story as well, that it's not a cultural artifice, but that we are wired, just as Noam Chomsky would argue that we are hardwired to have syntax, that we are wired to try to understand the world in terms of stories and sequences and consequences and chronology and causality. I can't prove it, but I believe it.
So that would be original syntax.
Ah, nicely played.
Yeah, I was prepared because it's a title of one part of a novel that I just finished. If I finished it, I mean, if it really is a novel, I don't know. It's an attempt at a novel that is about, well, this about language. And so, and Carlos Castaneda, just to throw a spanner in everything. Do you know Carlos Castaneda? I mean, not personally, but the work.
Yes, I don't know if I've read an entire work by him, but there was a time in my life when it seemed like I ought to.
Mm. Well, the time may have passed, I don't know, but this may interest you anyway. In his last book, he This was after he died, so it was post-mortem work, and I think it might have been put on hold. Like, he might have insisted that it not be published till after he died, because it had what he called the sorcerer's secret of secrets, and that is that syntax was implanted in us by a foreign entity from outside of space-time. It's very Lovecraftian, and I'm paraphrasing now. He didn't describe it in science fictional terms, but there's a predatorial entity that feeds on human awareness that came into this Earth sphere or this universe. I don't know how far afield that it emerged from, but essentially dominated us by giving us its mind, and it did this by giving us syntax, and this is syntax. We would allow this program to install itself into our nervous systems, that I guess is language. I don't actually know the exact definition of syntax, so maybe you can help me out. What's the nuances of syntax as opposed to just language?
I think I use it to mean grammar.
Right. So like the structure upon which language depends, or from which it emerges, or something like that?
Yes.
Well, that was a good shot in the dark. So, shall I carry on, or did you have any response to that Castanadian paranoid worldview?
Oh, I'm trying to fit that into my list of worries. But my list of worries is so big already, I may just have to pencil it into the margin.
You could put it in the margins and the top and the header and the footer as like an all-embracing problem underlying.
It's not entirely distant from some of the things in Keyhole Factory, where the idea of capitalism or greed or violence are viral, in the sense of being not viral in the contemporary sense of being something someone put on YouTube that became very popular for a week, but viral in that they're invading pathogens in our mind that are transmitted through our language. But that all of language is an invading pathogen, or all of syntax, or all of grammar.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to stay up late and worry about that.
Does it have its own agenda then? I mean, it must do if it's a virus, otherwise it wouldn't really have anything to do.
I do believe that whether it has agency or not, syntax does have its own agenda. The limitations of how we speak, what we're able to say, the ideas we're able to form, shapes our thought. This can be socially controlled, but it's also inherent in... Well, when I talked about a generation of people who have highly nuanced sexualities, they have to confront the awkward fact of there being three gendered singular pronouns in our language. That's definitely a limitation, which previously came up because he was the default, and this was offensive to women if you referred to doctor in the abstract as a he.
Mm-hmm.
The only solution was to change it to she, or to go plural, which is what I usually do when I'm trying to be politically and grammatically correct.
Same here, yeah.
But there's also, if you were a theist and wanted to talk about God but didn't believe that God was actually a white man with a beard, there is no good pronoun for that. I mean, I would choose they, but whatever pronoun you choose to refer to a God is, it's going to make assumptions about the nature of it that limit it.
Mm-hmm. There's always we.
Oh. Not bad.
So you're on your way to another point, though, I think, or a point, weren't you?
Well, I was agreeing that syntax has an agenda.
Right.
or English syntax, whether or not it is was implanted in us by beings outside of time and space.
Right. So yeah, I would definitely question the being part. But if we're talking about a virus at all, even as a metaphor, whatever, everything is metaphor, I guess, then it does not more than imply, it requires that it comes from outside the system. If it was inside the system already, it wouldn't be a virus, would it?
I am going to agree with you, though there are some current cutting edge biological research that suggests that some viruses have literally been had their DNA sequences incorporated into the human genome, but I don't think that makes a useful metaphor for what we're talking about. So I'm going to agree with you.
Mm. Because bring DNA into it, then the DNA itself could be a virus.
Could be.
And we really have a problem.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote a book about it. Actually, it was a bit of a paranoid book, occult book. It was the Occult History of DNA, in fact, was the subtitle. And the premise of it, I suppose, or one of the premises, was that we're DNA's way of getting around. It's not a very original premise, actually, but I was kind of extrapolating from that idea that DNA is itself has agency and is itself conscious, and it spins these bodies in order to get things done. So, but I also had the flies in there. That's what Castaneda called these entities. So that would be a real war at that point, like a war of consciousness between DNA and the anti-DNA.
What would the anti-DNA be?
What would it be doing? Well, you know, I don't really believe in the war model. I mean, anything's okay as a metaphor, but even now, I'd say it's questionable. So, but there is this thing about DNA. We're really going off the map here now. But the junk DNA. So, there's 90% or more of DNA has been arrogantly termed junk DNA by scientists who don't know what it's for. So, you know, just throw it in the recycling bin. I don't know if this is the theory I had in the past, but anyway, there's a theory that there's an entropy barrier for consciousness, and that at the moment we're on one side of the entropy barrier, and that's that small portion of DNA which is just purely biological memory, if you like, or biological cognition, or whatever we want to call it. And on the other side of the barrier is eternal life, I'd say. So that's the portion of the DNA which has access to outside of the time stream. I'm just really making this up as I go along, just trying to remember what it was. And so then the flyers, or this other anti-DNA, their goal, if you like, would be to keep us locked inside the entropy barrier, unaware of our actual existence outside of time as non-temporal, in this kind of language prison where they can farm us for our awareness, because I'm not sure how to finish that last part, but that last part is the particularly paranoid part, which Castaneda believed that we were a kind of food source for these other beings. And although I believed that for many years, and I still think it has value, I think it's very flawed somehow, because I think it's all us. At the end of the day, this is why psychology has become my fallback position, because I think the best approach to anything is to allow that there is no outside, really. The system is all complete. So everything is contained within the psyche. So then that's where I don't really accept that these other entities, but I haven't quite come up with an alternate way to understand this, because clearly there's something that seems to be hacking into our consciousness and making a god-awful mess of everything. I mean, I can't deny that, because that's my experience. Anyway.
Is that a solipsistic viewpoint that that you, for example, are just a projection of my imagination, and I'm a brain in a vat somewhere?
Wait, my if I saw myself as a projection of your imagination, that's
Well, that's what a projection would say.
Right, is it?
Well, sure. You want to be convincing.
Yeah. So it's very Philip K. Dickian. But no, it isn't solipsist, and I don't think he was either. It's holistic. So it's that we're all... well, all there is an awareness, is awareness. And awareness, well, when you're in it, I guess it seems like it's a system with many parts, and so you can experience yourself as one part of that system, and then, you know, everything else comes from that, like this whole categorized and compartmentalized experience we have of reality, which again I think comes down to language. Like, it's a chicken or an egg thing, but I think we assume that we develop language in order to describe a world of objects, but what if it's the other way around? What if language somehow embedded itself in our consciousness and started naming stuff, and so then we began to relate to the names, and then we began to perceive a world of objects, but actually there is no world of objects. We're back to quantum physics again, really. So
I'm with you. Perhaps oddly enough, you've laid a lot on me, and I just want to say I find it oddly reassuring that, if I'm understanding that part correctly, that it is actually my DNA that is the part with the agency, and I am just this kind of vehicle for it that has been duped into thinking it is in command.
You find that reassuring?
I do. This whole burden of agency that we've been talking about from various angles, that you and I can shape the future, but not the past, or you know, make decisions even though the rest of the universe is mechanistic. This entirely specious idea that you know, the entire universe is deterministic and its conclusion can be just worked out through math and physical laws, except for people, because we are, you know, we are different and free from all that, because we are creative and autonomous beings. I like having that lifted, even if it is because flies have implanted DNA and syntax into my system, and I am just a cumbersome, fleshy vehicle for them to carry out their agenda, which was unknown to me.
Right. Well, yeah. No, I think there's some sort of interference there. So, but I wonder if it isn't what you're zeroing in on, really. I mean, without having to posit some malign entity outside there, because I agree with you, it is a burden. Agency. The idea of agency is a burden, not the experience of it. That can be very pleasant, the experience of just saying I'll turn left or I'll turn right, and sort of, I don't know, just that feeling of autonomy. I think autonomy is very essential, like that, bring it back to individuation. That would be the goal, or the perhaps the synonym for individuation is autonomy. I mean, to be entirely unencumbered by social constraints and social conditions that tell us what to think and what to believe, and to be able to act spontaneously free of that conditioning, that's a kind of autonomy. But it's paradoxical, because I feel that the idea of agency is a false one, and it's been conditioned in us, socially conditioned into us, that you are a separate self who has to, you know, the onus is on you to create a great future for yourself and to leave the world a better place. God, I hate that whole notion. I'll just say that now. And if that's a basically false idea, that would be a burden. You know, besides just the fact that it can cause all kinds of guilt and think I'm getting it wrong all day long, which I have, don't know if you do, but also if it's actually false, then that that would be a burden because we're carrying around this false belief about ourselves all day long.
Ooh, double jeopardy. Yes. Well, I'm enjoying this conversation, whoever it is that's having it. Even if it was, you know, could have been predicted from the time of the Big Bang by someone who had the right instruments.
Well, I think that's a thing that comes up on this podcast quite a lot, is back to language again, that this conversation, possibly, let's say, is not dependent on language. Like, the real meat of this conversation, the thing that's happening that couldn't be predicted since the beginning of the Big Bang that truly is new, is the deep connection between consciousness. Well, see, I'm losing the language now, but a new interface of consciousness with itself, and that language is just a... what's the word for it? Pretext. So, like, I couldn't say, hey, William or Bill, whatever it is, let's get together and commune in the cybernetic ether. I mean, that's not something I'd want to do anyway, but certainly I don't suppose you would have accepted that invitation. Right? It's too weird. But I do think it happens. I mean, I've experienced this on this podcast, that there is something else going on that language can't describe or encapsulate, but somehow it can facilitate it. And this is also what I've been trying to get at with this novel I wrote, or anything I write. It seems like you were from Keyhole Factory, though I haven't read it, but the fact that you were working with the form of language and actually the visually, and so it's more of a sensory thing, I'm just guessing now, but I would guess from that you also have this sense that language is just the tip of an iceberg in terms of what's being potentially communicated through writing. Is that right?
That's right. I don't know if in this case you would, in our conversation, include... I think it's a very... I've never done anything like this. This is, to be honest, my second ever use of the Skype program, and the first one was... because I was setting it up for a teacher who had a virtual guest lecturer. I think it's a unique social or linguistic situation I find myself in, speaking to you, not looking at you, and it's very different and better than if we were texting. Because there's so much, I don't know whether you would consider this part of language or outside of language, but the intonation and inflection and pacing and all that other super compressed information that goes along with speech.
Am I interrupting, by the way? Like I say, I'm never quite sure. With you.
Yeah, I understand. I drift into ellipses a lot. Feel free to step into them.
Okay. There's something about what you're saying about verbal communication that they have said, that, you know, the experts, the scientists who've studied it, biologists, I guess we're talking about, there's probably a particular, you know, wing of biology, but anyway, or even anthropology, but that the communication occurs primarily or initially or first of all through not the actual language being used but the way in which it's being conveyed, so of course body language, but even the muscle movements in the throat, the shape of the lips, the position of the tongue, obviously the tone of voice, we already know that, but what they're describing is actually the micro movements in the body, but particularly the throat and the face, conveys information to the brain of the recipient more rapidly than the language that's actually being spoken, and that's primarily what we respond to, which then begs the question, you know, with Skype, you know, how much of that is altered by the medium that we're using and how much is retained, if it's true.
I believe it's true, but gosh, since we're talking about some really heavy shit, I hope that, you know, there's more than just our tones of voices talking to each other, and there are ideas in there as well.
I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. I don't know what it's all about. I'm feeling here, I'm feeling there, I'm feeling everywhere. Now that you're broke, who's gonna fix you up? Fix you up.
That's the end of the first part of this very unusual conversation with William Gillespie. You can find out more about William's work by following the links in the show notes. Part 2 of our conversation will be up at horticulture.com/liminalist on Wednesday, the 18th of November. I'd like to thank Keith and Dominic for donations in the past week, and nobody else. I believe that's it. Carry on. Songs this week by Robin Hitchcock.
Well, they sell you the stuff with the money that you never had. Then they want it all back. They make you redundant and blame you for being a slacker. While a financial backer is taking a call with a strawberry mousse. Now that you're broke, fix you up. You've got a mountain made of green, but nothing's ever gonna be enough for me. I'm breathing air, I'm breathing dust, I'm breathing anything that I can trust. Now that you're broke, who's gonna fix you up? Fix you up. Fix you up. Fix you up. Fix you.